opened fire on a Safeway store in Bend, Oregon, Sunday night. The shooter was also found dead at the scene, police said. In Houston, three people were killed and two people were injured early Sunday morning after a man set fire to a building and then shot at people fleeing. And in yet another deadly incident, a gunman shot at random in Detroit, killing three people and injuring another over a period of about 2.5 hours on Sunday, police said. The FBI has tracked a marked increase in recent years of so-called active shooter incidents in the country, defined as someone engaged in killing or attempting to kill people in a public space in a seemingly random fashion. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 88 degrees, partly cloudy. In New York City, 82, mostly cloudy. Daytime temperatures are expected to stay in the low to mid 80s in both cities throughout the week. From WPFW in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The time now is 1 minute past 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
I'm Leonard Lopate. In his new book, The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History, Luke Savage, a staff writer at Jacobin magazine, looks at contemporary politics, particularly those of mainstream liberals in the United States. It's published by OR Books and brings Luke Savage to our show now. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks so much for having me.
The opening sentence of your book reads, "I had the slight misfortune of being born just as the future was being canceled." Well, when was that, and when? Why did I miss that?
Wow. Well, you know, I was born at the end of the 1980s. I mean, just barely squeaked in at the end of the 1980s. I suppose I can't remember if it was before or after the Berlin Wall came down. You know, what I meant by that, I suppose, rather vague and evocative sentence was that, you know, I think I came of age politically in a world where the kinds of political horizons that existed perhaps in the mid-20th century or that we would associate with maybe the 1960s, those horizons had not only receded, but I think the very idea of political progress as people had understood it for much of the preceding, you know, 50 or 60 years after the Second World War, say, or from the 1930s onwards, that really wasn't present anymore. And instead, what you had was a new and much more conservative type of political order where, you know, there was a belief by this point, a bipartisan belief, really, that you know, moving forward in any kind of transformative way was no longer possible. So that was something you found, obviously, in the United States through the Bill Clinton presidency, you know, which I would say broadly accepted the tenets of Reaganism, you know, and modified them in certain ways, of course. But it was also true, I think, importantly, of the left as well, the socialist left, that is. Mm-hmm. You know, socialists, broadly speaking, had worked in various ways throughout the 20th century on the idea that, you know, some kind of significant transformation of society, particularly the economic system, was possible. And by the 1990s, almost nobody, I think, seriously believed that anymore.
Well, since the early 1990s, hasn't centrism been the consensus in Britain and North America in particular?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the really significant thing about that is that, you know, I mentioned it near the beginning of the book as well, but, you know, it's very much captured in you know, this now, I suppose, infamous turn of phrase by Francis Fukuyama, where he talked about the end of history. So that was kind of how grand the centrist vision was in the 1990s. You know, it wasn't just We've kind of settled things for the next 25 or 30 years or so. It was we've settled things forever, which I think has some very important consequences and implications for how politics has, played out since then. Because even when there have been major crises, like, for example, the 2008-2009 financial crisis, they are not taken as moments for, you know, reimagining the essentials or you know, transforming the fundamental the fundamentals of the political and economic order, which is distinct from the 1930s, say, where FDR looked at the Great Depression and there was a this huge climate of labor militancy and other things, and he decided that I think the phrase he used, in fact, was that he thought America needed to become fairly radical for at least a generation. And that's not the kind of sentiment that you're likely to find today.
And you're critical of Barack Obama for not having done more in that regard. But let's get back to Francis Fukuyama. His book, how influential was it? Didn't it become almost the Bible of the global emerging neoliberal corporatist consensus after it came out in the 1990s? But of course, that was also after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yes, that's true. I mean, how influential the book itself was, I think, is an open question. And frankly, I don't feel entirely qualified to answer it. I think for my purposes, what the significance of the book is and the turn of phrase is that it epitomizes, if you want, the spirit of that time. I think it's just very significant for a political consensus to think about itself in those terms, to think about itself as completely permanent. And we should talk about the Soviet Union. I mean, by this point, of course, by the 1980s, by the early 1990s, the Soviet Union was, a deeply dysfunctional society. And of course, going, go back a few decades before that into the 1950s, and it was, an incredibly repressive society as well. I'm certainly not in singling out the moment of the early 1990s, I'm not exactly lamenting the demise of the Soviet Union, but rather I think the foreclosure of possibility, future possibility that, a variety of movements, including, the democratic socialist movements of the 20th century had been associated with.
Well, you say that when you were a teenager in the early 2000s, the left really was very different from the left as it exists now. In what ways?
Yeah, I mean, this really struck me. I started thinking about it a lot in 2016, I think, with the first of the two Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns. When I first, sort of irritating know-it-all teenager, when I became involved in, left-wing politics in various ways.
But you were in Canada. Were you living here at the time? You're a Canadian.
No, I was living in Canada, although, as a Canadian, I was deeply engaged, as I think many Canadians are, with, what was going on in the United States. And this was true in my own country, and it was true in, the United States as well. The left was a very depressing place. You didn't find many people there. It tended to, I would say, broadly tilt a bit older. You certainly didn't find as many, younger people there. And I think much of it was very defensive in its posture. There would be, cuts to social spending or welfare payments or something like that. Name a cause, and our position would be, well, we have to stop that from happening. But what was missing was a positive project of our own. I really don't think we had one. And though I didn't see it in these terms at the time, I think, what I've realized since is that after the 1980s, especially, a lot of the left became more, it retreated somewhat, I would say, into the academy, and it became more theoretical. And that was a consequence of there being much less of a belief that things could actually be changed in a significant way.
Well, if you look at the current political situation, the people we think of as being on the left seem to have less clout these days than people like Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, I mean, I do think that the right, I mean, whatever we call that, the populist right, although I don't like exactly to use that term because I think it's giving them too much credit. But certainly figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene are, extremely visible and they're a threat. I can say more about that if you want.
Well, sure. Let's talk about this topic. For example, well, first of all, I want to get to your title. What do you mean by the dead center? It can mean exactly in the middle or that the political center is dead.
Well, it means both, I suppose. Although I think in the latter case, the more precise meaning would be, or the more precise word would be the undead center. Because, of course, the center isn't dead. I mean, the center in the United States
is where everything is right now.
It's in power, right? Biden, the consummate centrist, won the 2020 election and is in power. So in that sense, the center is not dead. But I mean something a little bit different by it. I think that the it's possible to be in power but not be advancing an agenda or an ideology in a significant way. And I think, broadly speaking, when centrists do come to power today, when they wield power, Barack Obama is another example of this, and I hope we'll get to talk about him in a little more detail. But Barack Obama, who tremendously gifted speaker, charismatic fellow.
Thought he was one of the smartest politicians I've ever met.
I think that's an apt description. I mean, I think he's the most skillful practitioner of this kind of politics, or he has been the most skillful
practitioner. But we expected him to change things a lot more than he did.
That's right. And so so that's an example, I think, of what I'm talking about. When even in the case of something like 2008, we have this very exciting election, people are very mobilized. It's right at the end of the financial, it's during the financial crisis, excuse me. It's coming at the end of the hated Bush years with the invasion of Iraq and the war on terror. And it seems for a lot of people, including my 19-year-old self, I want to add, it seems to represent the defeat of all those things, the negation of all those things. But then, I think just to go back to your question about the dead center, I mean, what you find is that, or what we found is that, even with that as the backdrop, there was not a significant effort made to change things in any kind of fundamental way. So dead, or if you want the dead, or if you want undead center, I think, refers to the fact that even when the so-called political center wields power, it's really exercising it within the confines or within terms that have been set, I think largely by the right and also by conservative liberals, if you want, as well.
Well, you suggest that Joe Biden has largely situated himself in the dead center throughout most of his career. You say he's engaged in milquetoast politics. But even though he's been an advocate of small government, hasn't that changed since he's come into office? Until recently, he was saddled with low approval ratings. But hasn't he had a number of recent successes that will please people on the left?
Yeah, I mean, this is worth exploring, and it's worth going into in some detail. I mean, I should say, the book was, the book obviously was assembled. Unfortunately, I'm not able to, update it with each successive development in the Biden administration, although rather neurotically, I'd like to. But it's a good question. And I think what I would say about Biden is that I think that his administration did break in certain respects. At least there's some degrees of difference, let's say, between Biden's first term and Obama's. I mean, Biden, unlike Obama, did come out with this big spending package. The first bill, I mean, I think that probably still the largest domestic spending bill of the administration was barely, I think just over a month in February of 2021 or something like that. And, you know, this had a lot of economic relief, you know, you had the child tax credit. I mean, measures that, you know, cut poverty in half, virtually cut poverty in half among children, I should say. And then Biden proceeded to roll out these very large, you know, initially it was, I think, a $6 trillion package of domestic spending, or $6 trillion over the next 10 years. So a little smaller than perhaps the number suggests, but still more than anything Obama was willing to do. The caveat I would issue here, which I think is an important one, is that I think the administration, by and large, is still, in spite of these things, pursued a fairly conventional political strategy. It has been very content, I think, to try to work within the Beltway, you know, and do kind of Beltway horse trading in order to get its agenda passed. So, for example, the decision that was made, I think, within the first 6 months to split the spending bill into two, I realize we're getting into the weeds a bit, but I think it's important, split the spending bill into two packages, one that was you know, kind of a would have bipartisan support, and the other one, which contained, you know, all the significant environmental and social expenditure. You know, that's the kind of thing that you know, you do if you just want to win. If you want to get a political win, in this case with the much more conservative package that has Republican buy-in. You know, that was the course that they took, and they did that in lieu of what I think. History suggests, American history and just history generally suggests, is what you need to do if you're going to pass, you know, if you're going to make something like the child tax credit or healthcare reform, you know, if you're going to embed those and make them permanent, and that is to rally and mobilize support outside of the Beltway, outside of the kind of, you know, elite brokerage that happens in Congress. This was something that I think, you know, to refer back to the 1930s, it's something Roosevelt was very open about, is that, you know, he saw himself to some extent in his administration as riding on this wider context of militancy and discontent. And so, you know, I think, again, to, you know, point out a way in which Biden has been different than Obama. You know, he has issued some statements in support of union drives and things like that. I think that's good. It's, you know, very positive to have the president supporting a union drive. But that's not the strategy that he's, I think, taken overall, has not been to, you know, tell his supporters to fill the streets in support of their, you know, in support of their agenda. You know, and I think that came out in, I mean, we can move on from this whenever you
well,
like.
Well, I have to do a little station break. Just tell people that my guest is Luke Savage, whose book, The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy, after The Dead Center, After the End of History, is published by OR Books. And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Streaming live at WBAI.org. Biden seems to have been pushed a bit by what the Republicans are doing. He's angered many Republicans by calling the extreme MAGA philosophy semi-fascism. And that's, a lot of Republicans are getting upset by the invocation of the word fascist.
Yes, I think that's true. You know, if the shoe fits, I suppose. But you know, I don't think there's anything particularly novel about that. I mean, I think since the beginning of Donald Trump's, I mean, since his candidacy began to look serious at the end of 2015 or early in 2016, perhaps, you know, the MAGA movement has been, you know, regularly talked about as extremist and fascist or fascistic in nature. You know, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton gave that speech in 2016 about the alt-right, so certainly upsets, it certainly upsets figures on the right, but, you know, we need to do more than that. They need to be more than upset. They need to be beaten.
Well, some people will never forgive Biden for chairing the committee that put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. So,
yes, I mean,
he has moved a bit since then, I would think. Perhaps history has forced Maybe Donald Trump has been one of the motivating forces.
It's possible. I mean, I would like to think myself that one of the motivating forces has been the fact that there is more, there is a more organized and powerful left now than there was before, both in a congressional sense. Some of these insurgent candidacies that have been successful from AOC's onward. But also, I think just more widely, there's, you know, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, I mean, the left is, despite we shouldn't exaggerate, it's not, you know, it's not a hugely powerful bloc, but it is more, I think it does have more power and influence than it did, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that to some extent is, you know, albeit in ways that I still find somewhat conservative, I think the administration is somewhat responsive to that, which is a difference, another difference from 2008 and what we saw with Obama.
Well, over the years, the Democratic Socialists have endorsed a wide range of Democratic presidential candidates, including Walter Mondale, Jesse Jackson, John Kerry, Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders, as well as a Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader, and some third-party candidates. But that's a wide range. Not all of those people are very much of the left, are they?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think it reflects, you know, what I was feeling as a teenager, which is that, you know, the sense of possibility that existed before, the sense of being able to change things, really no longer existed, you know, such that you get to 2004 and the Democratic Socialists of America are endorsing John Kerry because the posture has become, again, a defensive one. It's become about mitigating damage as opposed to advancing a positive program. I think that is, I think, what's captured in the trajectory you just laid out.
But as you point out, Obama was less effective than people on the left had hoped he'd be. I have a feeling that race played a factor in all of that.
I think that's true. I mean, I think there can be absolutely no
doubt.
People
assume that because he was African-American, that he would perhaps push the country a bit further to the left than he did.
Perhaps, although what I was going to say is I think that the currents that metastasized on the political right after the election of Obama, beginning with the Tea Party and culminating perhaps in Donald Trump's campaign and the MAGA movement, I mean, I think those clearly have a racial dimension. Racism clearly played a part in all of that. But, you know, I think, I mean, from my own experience, you know, I as a teenager, believed Obama wanted to be a transformative figure, that that's what he was setting out to do. And I think, you know, in retrospect, I think I've come around to the idea that, you know, it wasn't so much that he tried to do that and failed. It was that it was not something that he ever wanted to do begin with. And I think he's been very explicit about that. And, you know, the longest essay in the book, for example, is about it's a review of Barack Obama's volume one of his memoirs, which I, you know, it's about 800 pages long, which I read in excruciating detail. And I think he's quite explicit that that's not how he saw himself at all. And really the political genius of Obama and what he's able to do, I think, better than anyone else is speak in this kind of soaring transcendent register without really being very ideologically committed to, you know, a progressive policy agenda. You know, that was something that I think a lot of us learned the hard way, you know, after his election in 2008.
I should have mentioned before that many of the chapters in this book are articles that have been published in Jacobin, and not just the one on Barack Obama, but also reviews of books by Pete Buttigieg, David Plouffe, Matt Taibbi, Christopher R. Martin, James Carville, and you've written about Tony Blair, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, Chris Matthews, the influence of the tech industry, the impact of neoliberalism, and I want to go back to some of those things, but let's talk a bit more about neoliberalism and what that means and its implications.
Sure. I mean, neoliberalism is, it's a complicated beast, particularly because these days you will frequently encounter people, and the last essay in the book actually deals with this. You'll encounter people who actually deny its existence. They say it's a slur that people on the left, hurl at moderates or something like that. But neoliberalism is, it was and is a very conscious political project. It obviously began with figures on the political right, beginning in the late 1970s, where there was, a wider context of global economic turbulence for a number of reasons. And figures like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and I think, very, very adeptly and skillfully at the level of politics in Britain, were able to advance a really quite a different vision of society, and were able to embed embed their values and their vision of a society where, the market really was the main steering mechanism, and political democracy was subordinate to it, which I think is the main implication of neoliberalism. But then by the time you get to the 1990s, neoliberalism, its most fervent and zealous supporters, I think, often are liberals. It's people like Bill Clinton, who called, people, at least, I don't know if Bill Clinton called himself that explicitly, but certainly people in his orbit did. And Tony Blair, who gets elected in 1997 in the United Kingdom and wins this historic landslide, is a very conscious practitioner of this philosophy.
Rejected ultimately by one of the one of the least impressive politicians I've ever met in my life, Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson. Yes. Well, Johnson is an absolute clown. And I suppose, like Donald Trump, there are some differences between the two of them. But that is very much his appeal. He's like Trump. He's a figure of consummately a figure of the British establishment. Has succeeded, I guess, in having this, what registers for people anyway is this, populist aura, because he's so silly and he kind of makes a mockery of things. And
but yet he was able to replace Tony Blair.
Boris Johnson was?
Yes, wasn't he?
Gordon Brown, I suppose, comes right after
but
Tony Blair.
I mean, that whole political movement in England, he moved the country to the right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I misunderstood your question. That's true. But again, neoliberalism, when we talk about neoliberalism, we're talking about something that is now it's a bipartisan phenomenon. So Boris Johnson is a neoliberal, and so is Tony Blair. There are degrees of difference in terms of political style and in terms of the, to some extent, the constituencies that they represent, and that's true in the United States between Democrats and Republicans as well.
And what about in Canada? What about Trudeau?
It's absolutely true of Trudeau as well. Trudeau is certainly not politically identical to the Conservative Party, which is to his right. But broadly speaking, all of this contestation, if you want, is happening within premises or on atop premises, if you want, that I think are treated as settled. And that I think is one of the most important things, since you asked about neoliberalism. That's one of the most important consequences of it, is it's not that you don't have political debate anymore. It's just that the confines in which it's happening are much, much narrower. So the consequences of having, say, a Tony Blair versus a Boris Johnson, I mean, there are differences, but they're smaller than there would have been, for example, in the 1970s in choosing, Harold Wilson, say, British Prime Minister in the 1970s, over, Edward Heath, or to go back even further, Clement Attlee over Winston Churchill, or something like that.
Is it just my imagination that, or are politicians on the extreme right, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Greg Abbott, Ron DeSantis, Ted Cruz, do they have more clout and get more attention these days than Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib? Tlaib?
It's partly a difficult question to answer because the media, the media sphere is so siloed now that I think both of those groups you just mentioned get lots of attention, you know, on one, you know, for among one half, as it were, of you know, media consumers and you know, party supporters. But I think that that's still broadly true. What you said, I think. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tucker Carlson, Donald Trump, you know, name a figure on the right, I think they get more attention. Although I think that's partly a consequence of their not being in power. You know, when
and saying outrageous things at times.
That's right. And I think, you know, when if the polls were switched and, you know, there was a Republican administration in power, I think we'd also see the rhetorical polls switch somewhat. And I think, you know, what Republicans are able to do when they're not in power is adopt a kind of fraudulent anti-establishment posturing because, you know, they're technically not in power. You know, they're able to channel a sense of victimhood. And I think that becomes a lot less true when when one of their own is in power. Although, of course, you know, there was a sense of victimhood in a way that ran through the Trump presidency as well. But I think what you said in your question is partly a reflection of that.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times they are changing.
I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Luke Savage. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of his book, The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History. To do that, just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show. That's give and then the number 2, WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. And if you do that, we'll be happy to send you a copy of the book. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And we thank you very much. And I return now to Luke Savage. His book is published by OR Books, and it contains a lot of the chapters are essays he's written for Jacobin magazine, which you, Bhaskar Sunkara, the founder of Jacobin, describes the magazine as a radical publication being largely the product of a younger generation not quite as tied to the Cold War paradigms that sustained leftist intellectuals in the past, like Dissent or New Politics, but still eager to confront rather than table the questions that arose from the experience of the left in the 20th century. Is that where you see yourself?
I think, broadly speaking, that is where I'd see myself. I think that I have an aversion, I suppose, in a sense, to generational politics, and that I don't want to you know, ever make it sound in my writing or when I talk that there's, you know, belonging to a particular generation inevitably means you have a particular political perspective. I think that's a dangerous trap to get in. Having said that, I think that the sentiment that you just quoted from Bhaskar there is something that is very strongly felt today among you know, people under 40, let's say. I was going to say, you know, young people. A lot of us aren't so young anymore.
But so are you seeing a recent trajectory of younger people away from the liberal mainstream and toward the socialist left?
I think that's, I think that's exactly the trajectory for many of us. You know, we shouldn't exaggerate it. But there's an assumption which a lot of us, I think, make and is easy to make that younger people have all, you know, they're always the radical ones. They always feel this way. You know, there's a quote that's, I think, erroneously ascribed to Winston Churchill a lot of the time, right, where he said or is alleged to have said, if you're not a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative at 50, you have no brain or something like that. And that's how a lot of people think that, you know, politicization works. So, you know, presumably in 25 years, on the basis of that, I'm going to become a political moderate. I'm going to decide that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were actually pretty good. But it's not actually
by that calculation, since I'm older than you, I should be joining QAnon right now.
That's right. And the fact that you haven't, I think, is emblematic of, you know, this generational politics having a limited utility. It's just not the case that, you know, one's age defines one's politics. But it is the case that younger people today are more radical, I think, qualitatively more radical than earlier generations of young people, if you want, or they're more drawn to the political left. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but if you go back to the first Ronald Reagan election or Margaret Thatcher's first election victory in 1979, find that she actually, well, both of them won the youth vote. So they did very well among you know, voters 18 to 30, and then also 30 to 40. And what you find today is that, you know, the levels of support among people under 40 from, you know, for someone like Bernie Sanders or in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, when he was leading the Labour Party. I mean, these are numbers upwards of 80 or, you know, 85% in the, you know, in the context of the UK electorate, certainly, and in the context of the Democratic primaries as well. So there is something that's happened, and I think it's a result of the broad life experiences of people of a particular generation who've grown up in a political context that is constantly shutting down or that precludes, if you want, political progress and many younger people are downwardly mobile. You know, they're not able to have the kinds of trajectories that people of previous generations have because, you know, they haven't grown up with a welfare state and cheaper or free tuition and, you know, and you know, good, you know, good paying jobs that they could enter right out of college or even right out of high school. So I think that kind of thing has very much shaped the perspective and the radicalization of people of a particular generation.
Well, how influential have all the TV shows that deal with politics been in the past? Shows like The Daily Show and West Wing, more recently, the cable news pundits on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. Although CNN has just decided to become a little less politically left.
Well, this surprises me because I would hardly call CNN a firebrand network to begin with. But yes, I mean, I'm glad you bring this up because the response to the book so far has mostly dealt with, you know, the critique of you know, liberals specifically that's found in the earlier sections. But there's a lot more in there, and there's, you know, a whole section dealing with the media as well,
and that's why I brought it up.
Yeah, so I very much appreciate that. And I think that cable news is hugely influential, although, again, it's generationally influential because, cable news, the audience for it tilts much older or tends to, but hugely influential there. I mean, one of my favorite essays in the book is not about a cable news show, but about the West Wing, the television show, which, you know, I watched with great enthusiasm when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. And that was written originally, I think, back in 2017. And at the time, I felt that the West Wing reflected a certain perspective rather than, you know, having influenced it. But I think I've increasingly come around to the view that actually in that particular case, the show was very influential for people who went on to work in the Obama administration and went on to work in Democratic politics in some capacity. And I think it really did play a role in shaping, I know it sounds a little absurd, but in shaping aspects of the, at least the sensibility of the Obama administration.
Well, you know, don't you mean 1997, not 2017?
I should have been more precise. I mean, the article, the essay I wrote about it was in 2017. But this is worth discussing as well. I mean, the West Wing first aired at the end of the 1990s. Yeah. And so, you know, and I think ended in 2006 or something like that. And so in a way, it feels absurd. Why would there be an essay about it in a book published in 2022? But I think the reason is that the show was part of a small constellation of, you know, cultural objects that just became, overriding in its influence. And that's very important in the case of the West Wing, because as I argue in the book, it's very much a liberal fantasy. It's a very idealized vision of politics. But importantly, the idealism in the show, such as it is, I think is all about, it's all about appearances and aesthetics. It's about the reasonableness of the characters and their ability to compromise, and how stylishly President Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, you know, speaks. It's by the end of this liberal fantasy where there's a two-term Democratic president, it's unclear whether they've actually, implemented any significant reforms at all. And I think that's significant, because it tells you, it's instructive, that the fantasy is really one of aesthetics rather than political substance.
Why do you think so many blue-collar workers, who in the past were likely to be strongly in support of the Democratic Party, have moved to the right?
Well, this is one of the most important discussions, I think, in political discourse today. It is so important, this realignment of blue collar voters in particular, but white collar voters as well. This is going on not just in the United States, but all over the place. There's been a de-alignment of a type of class based voting that happened for much of the 20th century to a type of voting that I think is perhaps more cultural in nature. It has more to do with one of the single biggest factors in whether someone votes Democratic or Republican is whether they have a college degree, for example.
But a lot of those blue collar workers were union members. Wouldn't that have kind of suggested that they would have a more liberal attitude?
Well, historically, it would, and this is part of the...
Is it the change in unions? Is that part of the problem?
There are a number of factors that I think are working in tandem to produce this dynamic we see today. One of them is, yes, the fact that there's a concerted onslaught against unions in the 1970s and especially in the 1980s. I mean, epitomized by Reagan's, war on the air traffic controllers in particular, and in Britain, Thatcher's war on the miners. At the same time, right, the actual economic base for unionization, manufacturing, part of the neoliberal project is to outsource those jobs elsewhere so that, the people who own those companies have lower labor costs and are thus able to draw higher profits. I mean, that was really the point of it. So all of that's going on. But, in the 1990s, just specifically talking about the Democratic Party, I mean, there is a concerted attempt. They're not trying to keep many of those voters.
Can I interrupt for a second? The rules of American politics have favored small rural states since the country's beginning. And haven't Democratic Party leaders seemed to have done little to counter Republicans' efforts to siphon away less educated voters by using things like religious controversies?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I think at the same time, the Democrats have, from Bill Clinton onwards, the so-called Atari Democrats, really up until the present, have been much more interested in, centering their own constituency on a much more affluent and suburban type of voter. There was a now ominously prophetic remark that Chuck Schumer gave just before the 2016 election, which of course Democrats lost, where he said, for every blue collar voter we lose in Ohio, we're going to pick up three in the suburbs of Philadelphia, or something that was something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing, but that really sums up the attitude of Democratic strategists and the ideology of the Democratic Party, the reigning one, for the past 25 or 30 years. There's a sense that, well, we don't actually need this blue collar constituency. You know, if they vote for us, great. But, you know, if not, we're going to try to win the suburbs. And that strategy failed absolutely disastrously in 2016, because, of course, Trump's victory in the Electoral College, he lost the popular vote, was enabled by victories in Ohio, in Wisconsin, which was, you know, Wisconsin was a bastion of American, not just liberalism, but radicalism going back, you know, 100 years or so. It wasn't just that Trump won. It was the nature of the victory and the failure of the Democratic strategy that was important to that. And, you know, that strategy had to do with courting more affluent, educated, white collar voters at the expense of the blue collar ones that had been in the Democratic coalition, I suppose, from the 1930s, especially onward.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large is Luke Savage. His book, The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History, is published by O.R. Books. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. The FCC wants me to say that. The U.S. President's party has historically done worse in off-year elections. But the current prognosis is unclear. What's your take on what's going on?
Well, I agree that the prognosis is unclear, and I'm always wary about making predictions. But I think if I'm correctly identifying what I think is the subtext of your question, you know, I think there had been a view the Democrats were inevitably headed for a wipeout because of the, you know, the tradition that you mentioned.
And the fact that Biden's ratings were incredibly low and mm-hmm. the economy seemed to be suffering. And now they've improved to the point where Mitch McConnell has suggested that they're likely to gain seats in the Senate.
Yes, and I mean, this really would be a break with tradition. And I think there are two possible explanations. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, one of them is the fact that, you know, in a diminished form, you know, Biden did, you know, cancel up to $10,000 of student debt for people, mm-hmm. which is just, you know, that's a concrete, you know, deliverable. It's not, you know, initially the promise was to do a lot more than that. But when you put money in people's pockets, you know, guess what? They like it. And that was the same. You know, Biden's approval ratings were soaring at the start of his first term because of, you know, the huge spending package, the American Rescue Plan that was passed, and all of the relief, the unemployment checks and, you know, other income supports that were delivered. And I think we're seeing a version of that today as well. The other thing I would say is, I mean, I really do think that the overturning of Roe versus Wade, which was, you know, the Republican Party has been extreme for a long time. But this is, you know, this is absolutely horrific what this Supreme Court captured by, you know, right wing justices, majority of whom were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. A number of whom have ties to the Federalist Society. You know, this decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, I think, has understandably and rightly been very radicalizing for people. It's may have been a case of political overreach for the Republican Party. They've overreached before, but in this case, I think there's rightly a backlash against it. And the Democrats, being the other party, are you know, it's possible they will benefit from that.
I'm assuming that there are Republican women who've had abortions.
Yes, I think that's a very safe assumption. And I mean, it's important to register the wider significance of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, because so much of what you know, are the big agenda items for the conservative right today are supported by a very small minority of people. That's true of reproductive rights. It's true on voting rights as well. I mean, you know, most people think voting should be relatively easy, that the franchise shouldn't be restricted on racial or any other grounds. And, you know, most people didn't support the huge tax cut for billionaires and other wealthy people that passed during the Trump presidency. But again and again, you know, Trump, Mitch McConnell, and the Republican Party have been very adept at pushing minority agenda without a lot of popular buy-in through the structures of American politics, which are very captured by special interests and organized money, and which also, as you said earlier, favor rural states and are anti-majoritarian by design. The U.S. Senate is one of the most undemocratic bodies in the upper houses, rather, I think probably anywhere in the democratic world.
And it goes back to the writing of the Constitution. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I just want you to address a couple of the people you've written about in your book, their possible futures in American politics. Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, in particular. Anything you want to say about where you see things are going, especially since many people are predicting that Biden may not decide to run for a second term?
Well, I think all of those people, possible exception of O'Rourke, but possibly all of them would be potential candidates if Biden were not to run for re-election. I think Buttigieg in particular is, I think he's being openly talked about in some circles as a potential candidate. In terms of their, appearances in the book, a lot of the essays, or some of the essays anyway, were written during the primaries and had to do with the particular shades and styles of centrism that I thought these various figures represented. So, I have my doubts that any of these are have much viability, electoral or otherwise. When Beto O'Rourke declared his presidential campaign and was on the cover of Vanity Fair, he was talked about as the second coming of Robert Kennedy, and his campaign burnt out in a few weeks. Amy Klobuchar was somebody who, and this is why I included her in the book, she's somebody who was talked about over and over again by certain figures in the media as the most electable candidate, which was premise, I think, belied somewhat by the fact that she kept coming in fourth or fifth in primaries. So the most electable candidate, who very, very few people, who aren't on an editorial board somewhere, seem interested in voting for. And, Pete Buttigieg was somebody who performed best in Iowa, which, is a place that, historically is a place where, it's distinct as a caucus from other contests, because it's a small state, and by the nature of being a caucus, it's a little different. And as soon as things moved on from Iowa, he was not very effective either electorally. But he is still somebody that is talked about today as a future presidential candidate. I personally find that very baffling, but I think, broadly speaking, a lot of this has to do with, the promotion of somebody like him has to do with trying to work within the template set out by Barack Obama, who, of course, did practice the same kind of politics, I would argue, much more effectively and skillfully. There's just a desire. Okay. I'm being too long-winded, but this very much, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think you cover a lot of important subjects here, and I'm very pleased that we had an hour to talk about them. I've been speaking with Luke Savage, a staff writer at Jacobin, whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Statesman, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. And his book is The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History, published by OR Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much, Leonard. Take care.
And that brings us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our nearly 700 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which has surpassed 1 million plays, available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. You can check us out on Twitter. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give to WBAI.org right now. That's give and then the number 2WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content information you don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, you can get a copy of the book we've been discussing if you make a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate right now. The book, The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History by Luke Savage. So why not make that call right now at 212-209-2950. Go online to give to WBAI.org. You might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy. And you will say thank you if you do that, if $10 a month or more with a WBAI tote bag. But either way, the important thing is to make that tax-deductible contribution to help keep this station going. We're the only one on the New York radio dial that is 100% listener-sponsored. And we hope you can join us tomorrow when my guests Bill Halverson and Joshua Reno will discuss their new book, Imagining the Heartland. We'll see you then.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. NASA has postponed its newest mission that will take astronauts back to the moon for the first time in 50 years. Called the Artemis Project, the rocket was set to launch this morning but was canceled because of a slew of last-minute problems. As minutes ticked away from today's expected launch time, NASA repeatedly stopped and started the fueling of the Space Launch System rocket because of a leak of highly explosive hydrogen. They eventually succeeded in reducing the leakage to acceptable levels. This leak happened in the same place that saw seepage during a dress rehearsal in the spring. The Artemis 1 rocket is the most powerful rocket ever built by NASA, standing 322 feet tall and weighing almost 6 million pounds when fully fueled. That's more powerful than the Saturn V that took the Apollo astronauts to the moon in July 1969. Today's intended mission with Artemis 1 was scheduled to last 6 weeks, ending with the capsule returning to Earth and a splashdown in the Pacific in October. Now, however, the next launch attempt will not take place until Friday at the earliest, but could be delayed until mid-September or later. As the war between Russia and Ukraine continues past the six-month mark, Ukraine indicated this morning that shaping operations are underway in the southern part of the country. Shaping operations are standard military practice prior to an offensive attack and involve striking weapon systems, command and control, ammunition depots, and other targets to prepare the battlefield for planned advances. The United States believes that Ukraine's long-awaited counteroffensive attack will include a combination of air and ground operations. These plans come days after America pledged an additional $3 billion in aid to Ukraine. Commenting on the shaping operations, a spokesperson for Ukraine's Operational Command South said, and I quote, "Yes, Ukrainian forces have started the offensive actions in several directions on the South Front towards liberating the occupied territories. All the details will be available after the operation is fulfilled," end quote. To your city news, in New York, police agencies have removed more than 6,000 illegal guns from communities across New York State during the first 7 months of the year, which is a 20% increase when compared to the same time frame in 2021. Yesterday, Governor Kathy Hochul tweeted a picture of herself being shown some of those illegal weapons. Regarding their removal, she stated, and I quote, "My administration is laser-focused on stopping the devastation caused by gun violence in communities across the state. This record number of gun seizures is the result of an unprecedented, nation-leading coordinated response among dedicated law enforcement professionals on the local and federal levels. I'd rather be in the crime prevention business than the crime solving business. And thanks to the first-of-its-kind Interstate Gun Task Force, that's exactly what we are doing together," end quote. In the D.C. area, today was the first day of school for hundreds of thousands of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia students. Prior to the first day, mobile vaccine clinics had been set up to help D.C. children aged 6 months and older get their essential vaccinations, including but not limited to the COVID shot or booster when applicable. Tomorrow's mobile clinic is scheduled to be at Washington Leadership Academy, 3015 4th Street, Northeast. The mobile clinics have operated from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and from 1 to 3:40 p.m. In today's weather, it's currently about 84 degrees in New York and 89 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.